radiation. The gift that keeps on giving. Not that you want it to. When it comes to Three Mile Island, the cover-up of radiation releases and resulting damage to people and the environment has been pretty thorough. So most people think that no damage has been done, or no significant damage was done by that 1979 nuclear meltdown, and that everything is A-OK. But then a local citizen who lived near Three Mile Island quickly noticed problems with plant growth in the aftermath of that radiation-spewing accident and started collecting plant samples to prove her point about the impact of the radiation released. And then, almost 40 years after that incident, she tells you,
"To this day, I'm still collecting them. Some of the trees, I think, were permanently damaged, so their leaves are a little bit different. And every once in a while, depending on where the radiation fell as a dropout thing from the radiation plumes, some of the soil is contaminated. Some of the soil, because of the radiation, they go through a process where they decay. And some of the radiation elements decay into nothing, and you don't have any problems. And others decay into a worse problem, and they still would be mutating and contaminating the soil. So it's a really ongoing thing."
Well, when you hear someone who's been on the front lines of America's worst nuclear reactor accident tell you that she's still seeing problems with vegetation 40 years later, you start getting that uncomfortable feeling that comes from knowing that you are in a seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with veteran Three Mile Island Alert member Mary Osborne, whose collection of malformed flowers and leaves that she found through the years after that nuclear accident in the area around the nuclear reactor has just been accepted into the permanent collection of the Smithsonian Institution. A big win for everyone interested in knowing the truth about what happened after that 1979 nuclear meltdown. We'll also talk with Robert Manning and Kenny Dubroff, founders of Nuclear Terror Today, a new website inspired by the work of Daniel Ellsberg that asks us to take a pledge against nuclear weapons based on three simple concepts, which we will explain a little later. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information then will probably appear in tonight's State of the Union address, Democratic rebuttal, and Bernie Sanders' online rebuttal combined. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 5th, 2019, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting in the U.S., where it's official. On Friday, February 1st, the Trump administration announced that it would suspend its obligations under a decades-old Cold War arms control pact with Russia, announcing the decision to stop complying with the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF. Trump pledged that the United States would, quote, move forward with developing our own military response options and work with allies to deny Russia any military advantage from its unlawful conduct. Welcome to Cold War 2.0. The agreement, signed in 1987 by then-President Reagan and Soviet Union leader Mikhail Gorbachev, bans nuclear and conventional ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers.
Russia has repeatedly denied violating the treaty, and who knows what the truth is. Response came fast and hard. Beatrice Finn, the head of the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017, said, "The only ones applauding the decision to tear up the INF treaty are the nuclear weapons manufacturers, eagerly anticipating the kickoff of Cold War II. Soviet former General Secretary Gorbachev, who signed the landmark agreement on behalf of the Soviet Union, said, "Do they really not understand in Washington what this could lead to?" That was rhetorical, wasn't it? A coalition of 10 U.S. senators, including Sanders, Merkley, Markey, Baldwin, Gillibrand, Warren, Wyden, and Harris, on Thursday introduced the Prevention of Arms Race Act of 2019. Not surprisingly, the day after the announcement of our withdrawal from the INF, Russia announced that it too is suspending its participation in the treaty. Russian President Vladimir Putin announced, "We will have a tit-for-tat response." American partners have announced that they are suspending their participation in the treaty, so we are suspending ours as well. Earlier, on Tuesday, January 29, Congressman Ted Lieu of California and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts reintroduced legislation to prevent the president from launching a nuclear first strike without congressional approval. The state of Nevada is the definition of not happy, as they've learned that a half metric ton of weapons-grade plutonium was secretly shipped from South Carolina to the Nevada National Security Site, located about 65 miles northwest of Las Vegas. Now, the state is appealing a federal judge's ruling to allow the future transfer of nuclear material from South Carolina. Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak said that he is beyond outraged by this completely unacceptable deception and the U.S. government's reckless disregard for the safety of Nevadans. In another case of nuclear political dyslexia, the Environmental Protection Agency has appointed Brant Ulsh, a scientist who argues for easing regulations on lower-level radiation exposures, to lead the agency's, wait for it, Radiation Advisory Committee. He does not believe in the National Academy of Sciences' Beer 7 report on biological effects of ionizing radiation, which states that there is no threshold for radiation exposure that is risk-free. In New Jersey, below freezing temperatures shut down the Salem nuclear reactor after ice accumulated on screens used to filter out debris before water from the Delaware River is pumped into the plants. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
The U.S. Pentagon wants to be able to fly small nuclear reactors in transport jets. What could go wrong? This is the latest in the campaign to be able to empower cute little nukes, modular Legos, and, gee, it's portable. Next, they'll be telling us it's a solar-powered nuke. The Department of Defense wants a portable nuclear reactor the size of a main battle tank that's capable of being lifted to overseas hotspots that will only then get even hotter. It's akin to a nuclear reactor that, between 1964 and 72, operated at the U.S. Research Station at McMurdo Station, Antarctica. As we reported on last week's show, locals from New Zealand called it Nuki Poo in honor of the fact that the reactor malfunctioned 438 times over its 8 years of operation, a reliability rate of just 72%. It was also implicated in a spike in cancer-related deaths. Oops! And that's why Department of Defense proponents of a brand new generation Nuki Poo, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
Over to Japan, where Tokyo 2020 No-Olympics organizers have cut the size of crowds allowed at sailing events over tsunami risks and to make evacuation easier in case one happens. But of course, there's no evacuation plan for those facing radiation risks from Fukushima, even though there are softball and baseball games that are scheduled to take place at Fukushima's Azuma Stadium, only 37 miles away from the triple nuclear meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi. How's this for timing? Fukushima Prefecture Government Masao Uchibori has promoted the safety of foods from northeastern Japan Prefecture during his visit to Hong Kong that started on Thursday, January 31st. Hong Kong introduced restrictions on food imports from the prefecture after the triple meltdown occurred. At the exact same time that Uchibori was flogging Japanese products from Fukushima, radioactive cesium exceeding the state limit has been detected in fish caught off Fukushima Prefecture for the first time in about 4 years. This according to the prefecture's Fishing Cooperatives Association. And on the website, we will link to a downloadable PDF of the document, "The Japanese Government is Lying to the International Community. The radiological situation in and around Fukushima is not safe." It's by Atsuji Watanabe, who is a member of the Japanese Anti-Radiation Citizen Scientist Group and collects data and analyzes it. We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, as I shared last week, the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor meltdown is coming up the end of March, and I both need and want to be there. Need, because this is an important milestone in nuclear history. And want, because it happened when I was there. And I want to bear witness to this momentous time as I meet up with others who lived through that horrifying experience and live with its aftermath still. There are stories from Three Mile Island that haven't been told, that need to be told. And that's what I want to do when I'm there. Get those stories to be able to pass them on to you. Now, every week I ask for donations to Nuclear Hot Seat because truly, that's the only way that allows this show to keep going. I want to thank all of you who already donate, be it a one-time assist or that small and loyal core of you who help on an ongoing basis with a monthly recurring donation of $5 or more. Without your help, this show would have had to fold under its own financial weight a long time ago. Now I am asking again for your help to get me to Three Mile Island, and this is over and above our monthly operating costs, so it's going to take a separate push to cover airfare, ground transportation, meals, and lodging, and trust me, I keep things really modest. But without your support, I won't be able to go, and this historic time at Three Mile Island will be gone forever. So if you can help, please do it now, so I can take advantage of lower airfares to get myself to TMI for the 40th. It's easy to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to make a one-time donation or to set up an automatic recurring donation of any size. And for those of you who want to support the show in a way that's easy and you're on a budget, on the website there's a big green donate button. With just a few simple clicks, it allows you to set up a recurring donation of just $5 a month. I need to make my decision, and if I'm going, make my plans about Three Mile Island very soon. So please don't wait. Do whatever you can to help now. And know that whatever you can do, you've got my gratitude. Here's this week's featured interview. Mary Osborne is a longtime member of Three Mile Island Alert, and one of my featured interviews for the annual Three Mile Island Anniversary Program. Since shortly after the 1979 meltdown, Mary has been gathering flowers, leaves, and plants that show the negative impact of radiation on their growth and reproduction. The great news is that her invaluable collection has been accepted by the Smithsonian Institution to be preserved, digitized, and made available to the public. We wanted to talk to Mary to congratulate her and get the lowdown on what it took to get the Smithsonian to value her collection highly enough to want it as part of our national science heritage. We spoke on January 17, 2019. Mary Osborne, it's always great to have you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Good to be here again, and with what's been going on in our planet, it's really critical that people get educated. So thank you for what you're doing.
Well, part of that education has to do with a collection of samples that you created after Three Mile Island. Let's roll this back and review for people where you lived and how close to Three Mile Island.
Okay. March 28th, 1979, I was living at Highland Street, Harrisburg, which is about 5.5 to 6 air miles northwest of Three Mile Island. I'm on a hill, and it's a clear view. You can see the reactor cooling towers from my house. And a lot of times during that era, when the wind blew to my house, I sort of had a strange metallic taste, or my face was burning a little, and I didn't have any clue as to what was the cause or even if it was a problem.
Was this before the accident, or this was only after the accident began?
It was slightly before. We were hearing stories. Things were in the newspaper, which I didn't know, but I saw later when I became an anti-nuclear activist that things were happening before the accident at Three Mile Island.
So with this being the history, but you not being aware of the source, what happened to you and what happened in your area once March 28th of 1979, the accident started?
Okay, a couple of my neighbors, there's only about 12 houses out where I live on that area. Two or three of my neighbors developed a thyroid problem. One of the neighbors across the street that had an old farm, one of the children died of a cancer thing, but that was some years later. And one of the weirdest things that was happening is in my yard, especially because I would do gardening and organic gardening, I would find leaves that weren't shaped right or colored right. My daughter, a couple of weeks or a month after the accident, brought me a cute little bouquet of daisies, and there were two deformed ones there that I never saw before. And things just started growing. Some of the leaves on the maple trees were getting different shapes and different colors, and some of the trees died years after, and things were just happening. And as I became an active member and attended most of the NRC meetings on Three Mile Island, I was learning what was going on. And when I was a student, a high school student, our science book had a picture of a flower that was not quite like a daisy, but almost a bigger one. And half of it was red and half of it was white. And it was in my science book. And they mentioned that Dr. Muller from Brookhaven Lab did the research on plants. And then above that picture in my science book was a fruit flies insect that were being examined by Arnold Sparrow, who did radiation treatments and experiments on insects and other animals. So I saw that when I was a kid, and I never forgot it. And then after TMI happened, I saw it again, and it just blew me away. But I do have a picture of a flower. A lady from Lancaster County, over 30 miles away from me, gave me a picture of a half-red flower and a half-white one.
So you recognize these as mutations. Did you immediately connect them to your proximity to Three Mile Island?
I was curious. I was wondering if that's what was going on, but it wasn't mutations. Mutations are specific. Most of them were abnormalities. Mutations did things in the future. And the botanist, Dr. Gunkel, who a lady took me to see him in New Jersey, he did the research also with Sparrow. So I did meet some people who knew what they were doing, and I didn't think I was a little wacky anymore, because I've been finding these all over my area.
How long after Three Mile Island happened, the accident happened, did you start collecting samples of these plant abnormalities?
To this day, I'm still collecting them.
They're still happening?
Well, some of the trees, I think, were permanently damaged, so their leaves are a little bit different. And every once in a while, depending on where the radiation fell, as a dropout thing from, you know, the radiation plumes, some of the soil is contaminated. Some of the soil, because of the radiation, they go through a process where they decay. And some of the radiation elements decay into nothing, and you don't have any problems, and others decay into a worse problem, and they still would be mutating and contaminating the soil. So it's a really ongoing thing in our area, in Fukushima, in Chernobyl, and where Hiroshima happened.
Give us a sense of what you have in this collection and how extensive it is.
Years ago, a Japanese guy came and totally changed my life. I had to take a week off to help him find stuff. But I laid my plants, pictures, and specimens on the floor in my dining room or my eating area, and he took a picture of it, and I have it here, and it shows a lot of what I have in my box, mostly maple leaves, dandelions, a couple of daisies, 3-foot-long dandelion leaves, and some flowers, some roses, and other things. And some of the things have disintegrated. They just practically turned into dust from, you know, being so old. But I have a little box of some of the flowers and leaves, and there's about 8 or 9 of them that I would like to show you. And I do have that picture that the botanist or the Japanese guy took, and it's pretty easy to see. They're in better shape than a lot of the ones I have right now.
With your permission, we will definitely have those pictures up on the website when we post this interview. Did you at any time try to bring what you were finding to the awareness of the government, MetEd, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, any of the schools in the area? And if so, what were their responses?
I attended the meetings and I did mention things, and sometimes I brought a couple of specimens along just to show them. Every once in a while, I'd put a few on the table where they were sitting because I already had a whole selection of mutated or deformed, I should say, dandelions. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had approximately 1 or 2 meetings a week for years after the accident. They were supposedly trying to make us not so stressful, and they kept denying that certain things were happening. They denied the radiation doses. They denied metallic taste issues. And it was a very negative type thing. And it's interesting because a day or two ago, JASCO, the former Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner, who didn't stay there as long as most of them, he wrote a book saying how dangerous nuclear power is. And he does mention Three Mile Island. I read a lot of that. He mentions Fukushima and Chernobyl.
Chairman Yatsko was my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat number 395, and we did a 45-minute interview where he got completely honest about his position on nuclear. I asked him some tough questions, and he did go into Three Mile Island for quite a bit on that interview. So there now is information from someone who was inside the NRC about the dangers of nuclear. But you were there on the front lines in the immediate aftermath of this accident.
Yes.
Was there any response from the public when you showed the samples saying, wait a minute, they need to take this more seriously?
I didn't have any problems with the public. There were a few problems with the Three Mile Island people, and some of the nuclear guys, the nuclear regulatory guys, were a problem, but nothing like the PR people from Three Mile Island were specifically negative with what I was showing. But I knew, based on the experts that I was in touch with and the Encyclopedia Britannica that had the same pictures as my yearbook did at school, the week before Three Mile Island accident, I had ordered a special edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And when I looked through with the radiation issues to learn a little bit more, they actually showed the same photo in their book that Sparrow did with the fruit flies and the other guy did with the flowers. And so I have that picture in my book. It's exactly the one I saw when I was a kid in school. So it's just incredible what happens in the future with everything.
Given that there was so much official pushback from Three Mile Island PR people, from members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, how did you proceed with this collection? Were you discouraged by it? Did it anger you? What steps were you able to take?
I was very positive with what was going on just because the experts that came to our aid all over the world, Helen Caldicott, Alice Stewart, John Goffman, Dr. Carl Johnson, Carl Morgan, we had experts from all over the world and many from the U.S. that were doing nuclear industry information and research, and they were supportive. They educated us. They absolutely educated us on the hazards and the plant stuff and some of the things that happened with the animals. We were learning for years and years and years because it's been almost 40 years since the accident.
And still the effects are continuing.
Yes, indeed. They're not as severe, or not severe, I should say, they're not as all over like they were, but every once in a while I find stuff. I don't even collect them all, only once in a while when they're super different.
Now, the collection has very important scientific and historic resonance and has needed to be preserved in some kind of ongoing way. And I understand that a major step has been taken to make certain that the collection is available for the future. Tell us about what that is and how it happened.
I met people, when I worked at the train station, you'd see people come from all over the country and some foreigners all over the world. And I always had my TMI stuff there. Once in a while, people would see what I was doing and they'd be interested.
What was your job at the train station?
I was just a cashier at a register.
But you had this information. And how did people respond when you showed them the material?
They were very interested. They were fascinated by what was going on. And a lot of people questioned what I was doing. But I'm telling you, after Fukushima happened, they came up to me and apologized for what they were thinking. And they thanked me for what I was doing. And these were a lot of people that worked for the state and federal government.
So with this collection now in hand, and I believe it is the most extensive collection of any kind of plant anomalies after Three Mile Island, what are you doing and what is being done to make certain that it is going to be available in the future?
Friends of mine, and Scott Porchline is one of the best, the people that are interested in saving this information and making it public is the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. They saw some of my things and they were educated by my friends, especially Scott Porchline, and they are interested in collecting what I have to donate. And I'm going to donate almost everything. There might be two or three different things I'm going to keep, and you know, for future family members. But that's the way it is. The Smithsonian is a fantastic place. They have a wonderful news book or a magazine, and it's going to help educate people. And nuclear is really, at this moment, in trouble. Nuclear energy. And we do need to go solar 100% because it would create tremendous amount of jobs and it would also help clean up our pollution on our planet.
I understand that the Smithsonian has accepted your collection. How significant is that? How often do they take in collections that people say, oh, this is important, take a look at this and put this in your...
I read an article about that and they were saying out of 100 people, they collect one per year. So for me, I'm the one for the year that they're working on.
Do you know what they're going to do with it? How it will be made available to the public to see what's in it? And will you have any control over how or when or how often it is displayed?
I believe, I'm not sure, but sometimes you need to sign an agreement. And in order to protect this, I would give them full authority to take good care of it. And some of it will be stored, and certain people will have access with experts to see things specifically, not just the photos. But some of this will be on their computers, and some of this will be in their library. And they have special places for special issues.
If listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat, who perhaps are not in Washington, D.C., the majority of them are not, and they would like to gain access to the collection and inspect it, is there a way, or will there be a way, for them to do so online?
There are some things that we did. It took a couple of weeks to put them on the computer. So there will be a website, I believe, for what was done. It won't be everything, but it'll be very, very educational.
Anything you want to add?
I'm just thankful that JASCO did what he did, because it really is critical to help our people in this country wise up and learn stuff. And we do need to help our planet get rid of the horrible pollution that's all over the place. And we are making better friends, and more people are really getting educated and are very concerned for what's happening, and they're hoping that the best will happen.
Mary, first of all, I want to thank you for being aware enough all those years ago to take evidence when it was so amply available, and preserving it all this time and following it through to the point where this will now be available to future generations. It's a great gift you have given to all of us. And beyond that, I want to thank you for once again being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, I'm thanking you for making people get educated, because that is the most critical and wonderful thing that you can do.
Mary Osborne of Three Mile Island Alert. We'll post some pictures from her collection of 3-foot-long dandelion leaves and other plant distortions and mutations up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 398. To get a bit more clarification on exactly what it took to get the Smithsonian interested in this collection, the ever-reliable Scott Portsline of Three Mile Island Alert had a few details to add.
Scott Portsline of Three Mile Island Alert was very involved with getting the Smithsonian aware of Mary's collection and also taking it. Scott, fill us in on that process and what you would like to add.
Okay, I was able to observe over the years that Mary had an important collection of specimens that she found surrounding the Three Mile Island area, and that they belonged to be studied by science. Well, a lot of people don't realize that the Smithsonian Institution is the nation's premier science museum, and they have a mission. It states right on their biological page for the botany division that their mission is to understand how man is influencing plant life. So I thought, oh my, I think I just found a home for Mary's collection. And I called the collections manager, and he was thrilled. He thought, oh my, we definitely would like to have that. And as Mary said, less than 1 in 100 offers of, it's called a deed of gift when someone presents a specimen or specimens to the museum, less than 1 in 100 are accepted. So they asked us to put together some information. What the team did was label all of the specimens. We photographed the specimens, took the data where they were collected and the date, and then any comments and observations that Mary had. We're going to be putting that into a database that will be complete with links that when you click on them, it'll also show you on a Google map where the specimen was located when she collected it.
That is fabulous. And I take it that the database will be available to the general public. Will there be a fee involved? Will they need any kind of a key or a code in order to get in? Or will it just be available?
It will be available for free on Three Mile Island Alert's website. It will be downloadable. In fact, that might be the only way for us to go. It will be a large download, but I think it'd be well worth it to see some of the things that Mary has found. And see, it becomes very convincing when you look at the studies even before the Three Mile Island accident, what can happen to planet life, and the same types of scenarios came up at Chernobyl and Fukushima. I want to just cover one other point, and that's the definitions. A mutation would mean that it affects the reproduction for the next generations of whatever plant specimen had the defect. And that's what Mary meant by it'll show up in the future. Fasciations would be just a one and done type of damage to the cells, causing abnormal growth on one specimen, but not the following generations.
A bit of additional clarity from Scott Portsline of Three Mile Island Alert. Activist shout out! The search for our effective ways to enroll people everywhere in fighting against nuclear continues. And now there's a time and energy efficient way to add your voice to those who oppose nuclear weapons. Called Nuclear Terror Today, this new website has a pledge and was initiated by Robert Manning and Kenny Dubroff after they talked with Daniel Ellsberg, he of the Pentagon Papers and author of Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Here, Robert and Kenny explain their site, the pledge, and how you can easily participate.
Robert Manning and Kenny Dubroff, thank you so much for joining me today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
You're welcome.
First of all, what are your backgrounds as regards the nuclear issue? Let's start with you, Robert.
Been interested in the whole question of nuclear weapons for a very long time. And after reading Daniel Ellsberg's book, it's called The Doomsday Machine, The Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And it's a complete history of nuclear weapons in the modern age and where it's going. It really is an existential threat to all of humanity. And even if there was just an accident, it would still kill millions of people. So reading the book was very enlightening to me. So I had the opportunity to approach Daniel Ellsberg and actually had four consultations with him and his wife at his home. And I'd say a large part of what's been created is from these conversations and reading the book, Doomsday Machine. It's very authoritative and very well annotated and referenced and complete from a person who is, I can't think of anyone else who is more knowledgeable about nuclear weapons than Daniel Ellsberg.
And Kenny, what is it that brought you to this particular project?
A lot like Robert, I've always been very interested in the nuclear weapons problem that we have. I've always just been stunned by the sheer number of nuclear weapons that there are on the planet. You know, we don't really need one. Why do we have over 15,000 of them? But I never really did anything towards it until now. I've always been a lifelong geek, and so I decided to help Robert in this project and put my skills to use in developing the website.
So, Robert, what was the motivation and inspiration for creating Nuclear Terror Today?
Well, I read about the Hawaii missile scare, and it really touched me in regards to how people reacted. You know, there was over a million people that were had the impression for 38 minutes that they were going to die from a nuclear missile attack. And so I tried to put myself to have some kind of empathy and put myself in their position. That's why we start out fairly quickly in the video, the four-minute video narrated by Peter Coyote. What is this? It must be some kind of mistake. And then, after about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, it's panic. What am I personally going to do? Where am I going to go? What about my family? What can I do? So these people, over a million people once again, were experiencing a life or death situation in their minds. We even highlight for about 4 or 5 seconds where parents are trying to put their child into a manhole in the street. So that's what's inspired me to get more involved in regards to creating the website and the four-minute video.
Explain to the listeners what Nuclear Terror Today consists of and the action that you want it to lead to.
It consists of a lot of background information if someone wants to go into background in regards to nuclear weapons. It's a whole spectrum of nuclear weapons in regards to missiles, submarines, artificial intelligence, drones, you name it. I mean, it's a whole spectrum of weaponry that's nuclearized and on hair trigger alert. We even now have a drone submarines, more than one. We don't know how many, but we even now have drone submarines. It only takes two people. They're not even on the ship. It's like drones flying in the air. They're in a remote location. Okay, in regards to what we want to achieve, we want to achieve the first steps in regards to controlling nuclear weapons, just the first steps. We're not calling for nuclear abolition or nuclear disarmament. That's not going to happen in the near future. Hopefully it will happen someday, but basically it's to take the initial steps. And what they are is for all nuclear weaponized states to agree to no first nuclear attack. The second thing is to take all ICBM missiles off hair trigger alert. The third is to create international nuclear weapons / space treaties with unannounced inspections. I'll say that once again, unannounced inspections. Actually, it happened with the Iran Accord, where seven nations came together, enemies, some of us, you know, Russia and the United States came together and created this accord, not with the current administration, but with the Obama administration. And the Iranians were inspected for 10 times by the International Atomic Energy Agency and found to be in full compliance every time. So those are the three challenges that we're putting out to citizens, Congress members, and Parliament members. It's a global effort. What's different about it, we have three pledges. I don't think, as far as our knowledge, no one has ever done this before, where there's a citizen's pledge, like for you and me, and then there's also a pledge for congressional representatives, Parliament representatives. It's a global approach in regards to committing to the first three challenges that I just outlined. And then there's a pledge from us to be as ethical as possible, to protect people's information as humanly possible. We're even going to follow the EU regulations in regards to protecting people's data.
People's data, you mean the names of the people who have signed on?
Yes, and their email address. And to protect them, we're doing everything that's humanly possible to do that. Because we know in today's world, there's so much hacking going on and fear in people like you and I in regards to what's out there and not wanting their information shared with whoever they don't want it to be shared with. So it's, so Kenny might want to say something about this also.
Obviously, my main motivation is making a dent in the nuclear weapons problem, realizing that by myself, I can't do anything, but all of us together, we sure can do something. And as a secondary motivation, and maybe more importantly, is to teach my kids and to teach other people that they can empower themselves. You always have a choice in what's going on, and nothing's completely out of your control. So use the skills that you have, use the knowledge that you have, and put it to use. And get together with other people that have different skills and different knowledge, and amazing things happen.
Speaking of knowledge, it astounds me that there are generations younger than, say, the three of us who don't really get the special problems that exist with nuclear weapons and nuclear war. Go over some of the many factors that make nuclear weapons different from just being a bigger bomb.
As I said a little bit earlier, they are an existential threat. What that means is we have, for instance, submarines, Ohio-class submarines that have cruise missiles on them. Now I'm just talking about one of these submarines, and we actually have 14. Talk about overkill. One of these submarines has 24 missiles on them, and each missile has 8 nuclear warheads, each of those 24 missiles. One of these submarines can devastate and kill all the people in Europe. So we've got 14. So the possibility exists, a very strong possibility exists, that nuclear winter could be created by an accident. Well, I'm sure quite a few people remember about the Challenger space shuttle, where it was down to a little washer.
The O-ring.
Yeah, the O-ring, right. And seven astronauts died. Okay, so that's a choice of accident, you know, just a mechanical failure. There's also the human aspect of this. You know, there's recorded in history irrefutably, particularly during the Cuban Missile Crisis, where two submarine commanders, there were actually three submarines altogether, Russian submarines, each of them had one nuclear-tipped torpedo. If that would have taken place, if they would have fired those torpedoes, President Kennedy would have launched all of our weaponry, and it would have been the end of all of it. What happened is they refused to follow procedures. And when they got back to Moscow, they were both court-martialed. And there's also Stanislav Petrov in the past who didn't follow protocol in regards to missiles coming in on the screens of Russia or Soviet Union at that time. He was also court-martialed. So it's like we're depending on human beings, just a few individuals that have so far prevented this from happening. And that's why we start out on our homepage with our vision, create a miracle. Join us in creating today's miracle. There have been miracles that happened in the past. Miracles like no more testing in the atmosphere or the oceans. That's a miracle. And going on from there, just like I just enumerated about individuals have refused orders or refused protocol and, you know, actually have saved all of us. And then there's miracles like the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of apartheid in South Africa with the election of President Nelson Mandela. So we're encouraging people to join with us and become active and create today's miracle. Join with us. Go to www.nuclearterrortoday.org. That's T-E-R-R-O-R.
We will have a link to that up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. What I want to get to here is you and I in conversation have discussed the fact that we've been lucky in terms of ducking the nuclear bullet for so many years, be it Stanislav Petrov or those people with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And your response to this is a petition, and we've all seen anti-nuclear petitions before. What makes this one different?
We don't use the word petition. We use the word pledge.
So what makes this pledge different from anything else that has been out there?
When an individual like you or I takes the pledge, if you read the wording of the pledge, it's like a commitment to go to my congressional representative or my senator and encourage them to take the pledge. They're the ones that create the laws, our representatives in Congress, both senators and representatives. So beyond the pledge, just signing the pledge, it's actually a commitment to do something for today and tomorrow and the next day. And also the same with the senators and representatives and members of parliament. When they take the pledge, it's a commitment to support no first nuclear attack, to take missiles off air trigger alert, and create treaties with unannounced inspections. It's more than just signing a petition. Petitions in the past, you know, even millions of people signing petitions have not worked. This is actually a commitment to do more, just taking a pledge.
There's also the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017 and has been spearheading work against nuclear weapons around the world. What, if any, connection do you have to that group?
We don't have any connection with them, but I certainly welcome their support, because what this, again, is the initial steps, the first steps to controlling nuclear weapons. Even Daniel Ellsberg and Patricia have said to me, face-to-face, that the abolition of nuclear weapons is not going to happen in the near future. This is taking the initial steps to control nuclear weapons. If that's accomplished, that will definitely be a miracle. And it's the only way it's going to happen. It's not going to come from the top down because there's too much money involved, defense contracts and lobbying and everything, that it's not going to come from the top down. So it's got to come from us as citizens worldwide, putting pressure on our government representatives who create the laws and create positive change. What hangs over us like the sword of Damocles is nuclear winter. Nuclear winter is a blocking of sun for a decade, 70% of sun for a decade. That's caused from nuclear warfare. No matter who started it, it's caused from nuclear warfare, blocks 70% of the sun. What happens as a result of that is millions of people dying, and any survivors are going to be contaminated from the high radiation, and then crops died, unable to be grown for 10 years, and also animals, livestock, wild animals, everything. It's like the end. It will not kill 100% of people on Earth. It's going to kill 99%. What kind of life they're going to have living, the ones that are alive, I certainly wouldn't want to live it. Believe me.
Even Nikita Khrushchev said that if there is nuclear war, the living will envy the dead.
That's right. Khrushchev and Kennedy were vilified by some of their military for being weak. Both of them. Total insanity.
And you're definitely taking a step with this. Give the website again.
NuclearTerrorToday.org, with a four-minute video on there narrated by Peter Coyote.
And also the pledge that anyone is capable of taking, and then sharing, as you request, with 10 other people so that they have the option of sharing. And hopefully this is an idea that will go viral.
If they want to do something, well, we want them to do something, and that's to share on their social media.
We will do our best to get that idea out there and to follow up on it. Robert and Kenny, thank you so much for this next step in trying to abolish nuclear weapons, or at least move us along that pathway to greater safety. And thanks for being on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Robert Manning and Kenny Dubroff of the website NuclearTerrorToday.org. We'll have a link up on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 398, so you can easily go there, watch the video narrated by Peter Coyote, sign the pledge, and then challenge 10 others to do the same. Here's today's final thought. I think the biggest problem with getting the public to understand the dangers of the nuclear bomb and nuclear reactors is that no one understands radiation and its dangers. Knowledge of its risks that was common back in the 1950s has vanished. It's been suppressed, discounted, and replaced by nuclear industry-approved cant about no significant radiation release, no significant impact on health, even as cancer rates, autoimmune disease rates, and other formerly rare illnesses continue to skyrocket for those in proximity to reactors, mining, and bomb test sites. There's even that hormesis nonsense, that radiation is somehow good for you. And even some of our elected officials have taken a slug of that Kool-Aid and bought into that argument. We who oppose nuclear proliferation, be it in bombs or reactors, need to find clear, easy, even entertaining ways to explain the problem with radiation and what it can do to things that live. Mary Osborne's collection will go a long way to opening people's eyes to the immediate and long-term impact of a radiation release on plant life. Epidemiological studies into health statistics in radiation-impacted areas can give us a glimpse of what the danger to human life has been. You can find this information in Radiation and Public Health's analysis that showed the highest rate of thyroid cancer in the country is within 50 miles of Three Mile Island, or the Penn State study that linked thyroid cancer cases to the nuclear accident. There's plenty out there running counter to these conclusions and trying to take them down. because of the truth about radiation damage and what it has already done to people and the environment, let alone what it can still do, were known, we'd shut down reactors and bombs and force the mega industries behind them to not only clean up their radioactive messes, but to pay for it out of their own corporate pockets. There have got to be ways to get this information across in a manner that is compellingly artful or entertaining. I once thought about explaining the difference between alpha, beta, and gamma radiation in terms of a tap dance. Maybe someone can come up with a cartoon animation or a video game. But it seems that if the general public doesn't understand radiation, what it does, and why it's so dangerous, much of the work that those who oppose nuclear reactors, to say nothing of bombs, will continue to fall on deaf ears. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 5th, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, and our friend Hervé Courtois, miningawareness.wordpress.com, The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, CNN.com, CommonDreams.org, TheHill.com, Liu.House.gov, KOLO-TV, Las Vegas Review Journal, Savannah Riverside Watch, KNAU.org, JapanTimes.co.jp, Forbes, Boston Globe, Los Angeles Daily News, ThinkProgress.org, Etsuji Watanabe, Nippon.com, The Guardian, SwissInfo.ch, TaipeiTimes.com, and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. A big shout out to you, Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world. You are in 123 countries. We're going to work on a new audit on that to see if we've grown any, but at least 123 countries on six continents and counting. And a big welcome to those of you who listen on our growing network of broadcast stations around the U.S. If you know of a local community station that would be interested in this kind of programming, we'd be glad to talk with them and provide the program at no cost as long as they are a nonprofit. Thanks for visiting the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat blog page. If you haven't stopped by yet, come on down and check it out. Click like, follow, post, and share. You can find our back episodes, all 397 of them. Sometimes I look at that number and I'm a little staggered by it. But you can find them all at nuclearhotseat.com. If you add /blog to the URL, you'll be able to scan 10 episodes at a time. And if you want to know more about my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat, you can learn about it by going to nuclearhotseat.com/book. It's available to all of you on Amazon. To get each week's Nuclear Hot Seat delivered by email, just go to the website, scroll down for a yellow box, and sign up for a weekly email link to the latest show. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that as Hiroshima survivor Setsuko Thurlow said upon accepting the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, the nuclear arsenal represents a self-destruct button for the human race. To which we add, let's do what we can to keep it out of the hands of the children. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all truly in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.